Welcome to The Consult Room, the podcast that celebrates pets and people. I'm Dr. Paul Mangtalo. I'm a veterinary surgeon with a passion for the rich insights and stories about pets in the modern world that we live. Whether you're a pet owner, a pet professional, or you just love hearing about pets, then this is the space for you. Today is all about dog behaviour, and I'm super excited to be talking to someone who has dedicated his whole life and career to improving the lives of dogs through better communication and helping owners understand the language that their dog speaks. A big welcome to Nigel Reed, otherwise known as the Dog Guardian. Nigel is an author and dog behavioural expert with 15 years' experience working with all types of problem behaviour. Nigel regularly appears on TV and radio, and his book, The Dog Guardian, was a bestseller on Amazon, and his videos on YouTube have millions of views. Nigel was a founder of the Wolf Within Project, and he's worked with thousands of clients over the years, some of which have been very high-profile celebrities. Nigel, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, pleasure. Good to see you again. You all right?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very good. So, Nigel, you are, in my opinion, one of the leading dog behavioural experts in your field. But I just wanted to know how you actually landed in this career. What was your calling to be a dog behaviourist?
It was definitely inside me, in a sense that I just love dogs with an absolute passion. But I want to make something very clear immediately. I do not have an affinity with dogs. It's not a natural talent. I think that when people do claim that, it comes across a little bit cheesy and manufactured, whereas it was all learned. I got so much stuff wrong, but I love them that much. I was determined to get it right. And one of the big things with that was I kept having to look at my own behavior. And once I got my behavior right, I got it right.
That's really interesting you said that. So when you said I don't have an affinity with dogs, I immediately thought, oh, do you not like them? What do you mean by that?
I mean that I've got no natural skills with them.
Nothing
at all. Maybe I've got the terminology wrong there, because I've got an affinity with them in a sense that I love them, but I don't have an affinity in that. I've got this massive affinity, like I understand what they're thinking. No, I did not understand what they're thinking. I made 1,000 mistakes, embarrassing mistakes, and look back and I'm ashamed and what I've done in the past with dogs and how angry I've got. But it was all like they were holding a mirror up to me and what I was doing wrong. And it was one of the best lessons I've ever had in my life. And I can thank dogs for that, as well as many other things.
So that's really interesting. So when people say to me, oh, you're a vet, oh, you must really love animals. And I always kind of say, do you know what, actually, if I was goo goo gaga about animals, which is the kind of love that I think people are referring to, which is like, oh, you just want to hold kittens and funny things like that, I don't think I'd be able to do my job properly, because I think you have to have a certain level of objectivity to work with in that field with dogs and with animals. Because if you are going to be on an emotional roller coaster every time you have to do your job, I don't think you're going to last very long in the profession, which I think is very similar to veterinary, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And the hardest dog you'll ever train is your own dog, because there's that emotional attachment. And I had that. And when I started training other people's dogs, I still had an emotional attachment because I love them so much. But it was a lot easier for me to do. And it's a lot easier for me to learn all these skills with other people's dogs than it is with your average owner with their own dog.
So we're going to get into some specific cases, if you like, because and also I have some questions, by the way. I did put a shout out on social media, which is really interesting, because I know I have done quite a bit of live TV. And one of the things you always do in live TV is a bit of a phone in. Right?
Yep.
So you were always my go-to person in dog behavioural issues, of which I used to get so many questions. This is a thing. When you're a vet, people always ask you behavioural issues. Now, we don't have often the time and sometimes even the knowledge to deal with behavioural issues. So you always my go-to person. But what always struck me was that people were, it was almost like rescue advice. Problems had developed. Things had got so bad that the owners were like, I just can't cope anymore. You know, I can't deal with this. And that's sad, isn't it? And it is a little bit like veterinary in such that we're always often rescue and salvage. You're kind of like, you know, the sick and the injured, and you often must see dogs where they've gone past a point, or not past a point, but where they've got to a point where problems are causing a real impact on that relationship between the pet and the person.
Oh, huge. It feels like every week, to be honest with you, where it can affect your life so much, and it's something that we've really got to get right. And when it comes to a person, they've got all these ideas and morals in their lives. So some people have got this moral, like, I never let a dog down, I never ever give a dog away. And they'll have that rule-based thinking combined with, actually, I can't take care of this dog. Actually, I haven't got time. Actually, the behavioral issues are so bad, it's affecting my relationship with my children, and I can't get a partner because of my life. And it's so weird. It's so, I really got a big introduction to just general psychology of humans as a knock-on effect as with dogs.
And you refer to human psychology a lot in your book, actually, don't you?
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting, because I'm particularly interested in the relationship between people and their pets, but how often how you interact, or how you kind of own that pet, if you like, often is a reflection or makes you think about who you are as a person.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting when you look at that, but you referred to that, you know, just what you said before. So give me some insight into how human psychology helps you with dog psychology or dog behavior.
Because I think parenting, despite the claims, the words, for example, you know, oh, that they treat that dog like a child. Well, if they actually treated their child like that, they'd screw their child up as well. So I think there's tons of parenting analogies you can put in it. And I think that this sounds controversial now. You've heard it first on Paul Magdalow's podcast. I don't even like the concept of training. I don't like the terminology training. I feel like as soon as you use the word training and you're trying to train a dog to do a specific thing, you miss so much. Like, I'm not training a child. I'm not training a dog. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out why that dog's upset, or I'm trying to figure out how to teach a dog a response that I want. And yes, you could call me a little bit pedantic. There certainly is a crossover. But there's also this whole other world, which I feel like people often miss, because they're thinking, how can I train the dog? How can I stop the dog doing this behavior? Rather than thinking, why is this dog doing this behavior? Why is he upset? And if you don't ask why as well as how, you'll miss a huge piece of the dog training puzzle.
So in your book, you use a lot of words like nurturing and parenting,
yeah,
which is, I think, very different to what you hear in a lot of kind of dog training kind of forums, which is all about mastery and control. And like you say, trying to make the dog do what you want it to do without really trying to understand its behavior. Because my gut feeling is dogs generally want to please us, or they want to work with us, don't they? Or they,
yeah,
want to live happily, yeah, with us. And getting to the root cause of the behavior is kind of fundamental. And when you read your book, you're like, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. Whereas, like you just said, their training is like, stop doing that.
I'm
going to teach you to stop doing that, but not really understanding why you do it in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lovely quote that I use in my book that's not mine. It's from George Bernard Shaw. And it's, the single biggest problem of communication is the illusion it's taking place. And I think that's such a lovely quote, because so often we're like, why does the dog not understand this? Well, let's train them to do what we want them to do. And what is training? Well, that's a kind of subject that we could really kind of open up. What is training? Well, I train my dog, what, with a pinch collar, with shouting, with hurting, with constant treats. Then you think, well, what's the knock-on effect of that? And I'm not thinking, okay, what am I training? I'm thinking, okay, what you see, you're barking. What are you barking at? Well, I'm barking at another dog. Why are you barking at another dog? Well, I'm barking because I feel scared. Why do you feel scared? I feel scared because I feel like I need to protect us from dogs. Why do you feel like that? And then when you start putting that together, it always comes down to a lack of communication.
So what you're talking about there is effectively kind of root cause analysis, isn't it? It's really getting under the skin and really having a deeper understanding. Now, I love this because this is how I assess people. It feels very much like my kind of leadership theory, and there's a lot of parallels to that in your book. So just talk me through how you ended up translating a lot of this stuff as leadership theory, because I think it's really interesting how you denote the owner, if you like, as a leader.
Good question. And I think leadership, some people listening might get confused with leadership, but leadership is just needs provider, it's decision maker. So it's important to get that clear. And every owner is a needs provider. They provide food, they provide security, and they're a decision maker. They decide when to go for a walk and what speed to go, hopefully. And I had some big realizations because I was a very angry child, and I grew up with a mum who was very soft and a dad was very hard. And I kind of had like the far left parenting and the far right at the same time. And it left me very confused. And when I started training dogs, I had a need for unconditional love from some sort of childhood thing. And I had a need for unconditional love. So dogs provided that for me. But they had an unconditional need for leadership, for security, for food. And I couldn't provide that for them because I was 18, 19. I wasn't equipped to deal with it, especially with my childhood. And as I started trying to train them, I had the best lessons that anybody could have given me. You could spend tens of thousands on therapy, and I got it just by working with a dog because I desperately wanted to train this dog. And this dog metaphorically looked at me and went, "You're not getting it right. You're not getting it right. You're not getting it right." And I knew what leadership lessons were because you've been taught them. But all of a sudden, it started sinking in. It was like, yeah, I'm not being consistent. I'm not being calm. I'm not being clear in what I'm trying to teach. No, I'm not trying to manage the environment properly, am I? And all of a sudden, I had no excuses. So when I was younger, if anybody had a go at me, I blame them. Oh, but they're like this. But they're like that. But when it's a dog, you got nothing. You just know it's all on you. But some people have still got their get-out clause. Oh, it's the breed. It's the history. It's this. It's that. There's no excuses. If you've got a dog with behavioral issues and you're in a situation to train them, you can do it.
So as you're talking there, you as a teenager training dogs makes me think immediately of the Wolf Within project that you kind of spearheaded. And I was so fascinated by this when I first heard about it. I thought, my God, that is such a great idea. And again, it's that, you know, how do we gather self-awareness or that ability to look at ourselves and our own behavior through the actions of training our dogs. So just for anybody that's not aware of it, can you just give us an overview of what the Wolf Within project was?
So the Wolf Within was a project trying to teach rebellious teenage kids how to train problem dogs. And when a teenage child that's got problem behaviors is then being asked to analyze where these behaviors come from, then there's going to have a huge knock-on effect to how they're thinking about stuff. Rather than me going in there going, oh, you should behave, you should do well, you should learn at school and concentrate, that's just going to go over their heads. But when they've got something they can really grasp and know they can make a difference to, and the sense of happiness and confidence they can get from changing a dog's life, which I got, I was thinking, well, maybe I could teach young people to do this too. I would take on a group of young rebellious kids and I would teach them all the skills to train problem dogs, and we go out and train them.
And in my head, that works so well because you've got a kind of a naughty rebellious dog, if you like, for want of a better word, but maybe a dog that's reactive or has got behavioral problems and snarly and snappy. And what you're doing is getting that teenager to understand that behavior and recognize that there is a, like we're saying, there's a root cause to that behavior. Mm. And in turn, maybe thinking, oh, that's why I react like that. Why do I react like that? Is that what happened? Please tell me that's
100%. And it's exactly that. And I think as you were saying that to me, I was thinking this really could be an adult program as well. remember, you know, watching a documentary on Gordon Ramsay years ago, and his brother was a heroin addict. And now Gordon Ramsay is somebody who works constantly in shells of people. So both of them had a very similar childhood. Both of them are obviously got issues, but both of them have dealt with it in different ways. One, unfortunately, has turned to drugs. Gordon Ramsay's turned to work, which is slightly avoidance as well. And with the shouting, with the rage there, I mean, but he obviously chose the best one because, you know, he's an amazing father and he's done really well for himself, and full credit to him. And that really helped him on his journey. But there was certainly some avoidance there. So I think, you know, we've all got to look and analyze behavior of why we do what we do and why a dog does what we do in order to have a happy life and recognize issues in order to overcome them.
Can we just look back, rewind the clock a little bit? Because I'm always interested in the relationship we've had with dogs since the dawn of time. Now, we domesticated dogs, didn't we? And we took advantage of the dog's ability to track and their speed, ultimately for hunting. And dogs used us for food and security. But this is my understanding of dog history. But we no longer track and hunt prey, you know, do we? So why have we kept dogs as domestic pets, even though we've got no functional use for them? And I say that, I'm probably going to get challenged very heavily on that. Anybody listening who's got a dog. But how has that relationship evolved over time? Because we're talking thousands of years, aren't we?
The timeline, I suppose, let's look at the timeline. They were providing, helping us hunt. Then they got to the point where they were helping us sheep herd. But I suppose, really, it's never going to get away from the fact they provide company. And company is a need that we all desperately have. And they provide fun. And they appeal to our nurturing instincts. So it doesn't matter. We will die. If the world ever destroys and blows up, dogs will be our side this whole journey. It will never regress. We will always have them because they provide such a service for us. And likewise, we provide food and security, and they give us company and unconditional love. And that's just what so many of us need.
I did hear something quite contentious the other day where somebody challenged that we even keep pets.
Yeah,
you know, that we are we breed and, you know, raise animals purely for our own benefits. But when you talk like that about this almost symbiotic relationship we have, it makes me feel a lot more comfortable that we have. How do you see the relationship between a dog and their owner?
I see it as a relationship that works as long as we go in there with the right intentions. And I think that now, a lot of the times, people are getting a dog to fulfill their needs, which is a problem. But if you get a dog to fulfill its needs, then likewise, it will fulfill your needs in return. But it can't be the primary motivation.
So you must see where, you know, people approach you and say, look, I really need some help with my dog. What proportion of cases that you see are salvageable? What proportion of dogs can be adjusted back into a happy and relaxed and confident life?
I've never met a dog that I thought that couldn't be sorted, but I've met so many people where I thought they're not ready.
Right.
They're just not ready. They're not in the right headspace. They've got too much going on in their lives. They haven't got the time. They haven't learned the leadership lessons like I hadn't as a young person. And even like 3-4 years into my career, 5 years, if I met a really tough dog, I don't know if I was ready for that dog. And now, you know, it's been, you introduced me as actually 15 years experience. It's actually 20 now. It's been a while. And now I can really can't see a dog that can't be sorted, but it's just where that person is in the headspace. And that's not always down to them, because they are, everyone's in their own individual situation. And I certainly can't judge, you know, without putting myself in somebody else's shoes, but I've never met a dog that could be trained.
And what do you do in that situation where you are working with a dog and a person, and you realize that this dog in the right hands could be very different, but this person is not either can't or won't put the time and effort in. What do you do in that situation? That must be really tough.
Yeah, it is. And I put the feelers out and I go, okay, what kind of person am I dealing with here? Are they open to a little bit of suggestions? And sometimes I work with clients where, you know, the client doesn't even turn up. It's the helper. The helper brings the dog out. And then the helper's just got this list of things, list of demands they want the dog to do. And then it goes back to the boss. And I look at that and I think it's one of the most tragic situations ever, because one, that person has clearly got a dog to fulfill the family's needs. And it's like it's this robot that just needs, you know, imprinting, or just needs this quick fix. And then everything's going to be okay without understanding the nurture that's needed and the time that's needed. And these lessons, you know, I get it with rich people more than I do anybody else. The rich, the really rich people don't seem to understand. And that's obviously not always the case, but I get it more than I do with anybody else. The really rich just think it's just, I can throw money at it. It's like, you can't.
Just sort it for me.
Yeah, just sort it for me. Because they've used to that in part of their life. But with the dog or a child or your relationship with your partner, it doesn't work like that. You've got to put the time and effort. You've got to form that bond. And once you form that bond, it's just the most beautiful thing in the world. And I don't think you should ever try and bypass it with money. Mm. You know, why are we earning money? What are we doing to earn money for? Oh, because we can have a nicer holiday or a bigger house. Forget that. Let's look at what our needs are. Our needs are about food and security and having good relationships and having confidence in life. And that's what the dog has as well. So when I've been flown out a billionaire's place, let's just say, and it was one of the most tragic things I ever saw, because it was there to sort their dogs out, obviously, but I could just see that where it was and how I could not educate this person. Who am I to go and tell a billionaire what to do? It was futile, and it was sad. It was amazing in one way because it was an experience. I was like, oh, I'm getting flown out here. Oh, that's great to put on Instagram. Oh God, people are going to admire me because look, I'm on Instagram, and people are going to say, oh, Nigel's doing well because look, he's been flown out to this place. But the reality of it was tragic.
And I think, what you're kind of describing there is what happens when you leave, you know, because you do say this a lot in your book. It's about consistency.
Yeah.
Unless people are willing to put in the time, effort and energy, then the things are just going to go back to where they were, aren't they? So what are your thoughts around training camps for dogs?
You probably think I don't like them. Yeah. And well, you'd be half right, half wrong, because the reason being that I've worked with dogs, that I've trained them in inverted commas, I've boosted their confidence in their environment, and I've boosted their confidence in what they should be doing. And the person that I took the dog from, or the person who gave me the dog to do this, I do not think they're capable to do without it. The dog's behavior was so extreme that I boosted the dog's confidence in this environment that much, boosted the dog's confidence in what it should be doing that much. So when I gave it back to the owner, the dog was like, okay, the world's not that bad. So it wasn't half as much of a battle, and therefore the owner managed to carry it on.
I see. Okay.
So in some cases it's good, but I don't think it should be the go-to scenario. I mean, never say never. If we're going to get a dog, it should be our individual responsibility to train the dog. However, some of us find ourselves in some bad situations. So some people think, oh, you know, I'll get a Leonberger. That's a beautiful dog, but I'm only 8 stone. Mm. And now I've got a Leonberger that's aggressive. Why is he aggressive? Because he feels insecure. He's scared of other dogs. Okay, well, so if a trainer can go and make him feel more secure with other dogs and give them back, then the 8 stone person can carry those lessons on.
Yeah. This episode is sponsored by Superdog from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Like all members of the family, your dog needs a balanced diet that includes a range of vitamins and minerals to stay healthy and full of vitality. Superdog's chewable, tasty braised beef tablets are packed with over 21 nutrients, expertly formulated for your special companion. Superdog's available now at Amazon, Ocado, Paws, Superdrug and Vitabiotics.com. Talk me through some of the most interesting cases that you've had, or the ones that really stick in your mind.
One of the dogs that taught me the most, this is subtle, but I was walking a dog, beautifully walked on the lead, had no problems whatsoever. And I was walking with him, and this dog would freeze in this one spot, and he'd freeze, and I did not know what to do. I used to lure him with treats. Come on, no, come this way. But the dog was like, no, we're going left. I'm like, no, no, we're going right. And he goes, no, we're going left. And I thought to myself, come on, like, why can't you get this dog to do what you want to do? And I started teaching this dog again inside the house. And I started walking in the house with the dog and speeding up and slowing down. The dog froze in the house. But then I realized I've got control here. So I took the lead off the dog and thought, we're not going forward. And then I called the dog over and said, right, come on, let's go for a walk. And walked the dog around the house. Dog froze, took the lead off. And I said, we're not going out until you do not freeze. And I didn't take the dog out for about a day and a half. And eventually the dog followed me everywhere in the house. And then when I went back to that spot, the dog didn't pull me again. And what that dog taught me was that dog was always in charge of me. He was always thinking he was making the decisions. But the only time this got communicated was when he wanted to go one direction and I wanted to go to the other. So it was the subtleties of dog behavior. It was the subtleties of teaching dogs and training them, but not actually realizing communication hasn't taken place. And it's looking at the subtleties and nuances of everything. I love getting down to the grit of it. That's what really interests me.
There is an incredible bond between dogs and people, which has, you know, as we just talked about, has gone through the ages. But that means that, you know, me as a vet and you as a dog behaviorist are dealing often with very emotional situations. Have you got any cases that even you have, you know, struggled emotionally with them because of the impacts to either the dog or the owner?
Yeah, many. And it was all on the learning curve. And as you do it for longer, you become more stoic and less emotional about it. But yeah, I'm always invested emotionally into it to a point. But you've always got to look at yourself and go, have I done the best job I could possibly do there? And if you know you have, like if you've, you know, tried to save a dog and you feel like you've done everything and the dog unfortunately passes away, then you know you've put your all into it. But it's a sad thing. You can't help all dogs, not because I can't help all dogs because of their behavior, but I can't always help that person in that situation because, again, all the circumstances that's going on in their life at that moment.
What are the most common behavioral problems that people approach you for?
I'd say the most common problems dogs have are like jumping up and pulling on the lead, but the ones that people approach me for is aggression, because people don't look at what the problems the dogs have. People look at the problems the dogs give them. So a Chihuahua pulling on the lead, no one calls me up for. A Rottweiler being aggressive towards people coming through the house, people call me up for.
That's really interesting. So of the problems that people don't call you about, what do you think are the biggest issues facing dogs?
I would say the biggest problems that people have that people aren't fronting up to is an assertive behavior from the dog dealing with people coming in the house, which they then look at as he's excited to see me, he's jumping up, he's just saying hello. And they'll say all these behaviors, and so many times the dog is doing that. So people are right so many times. So your dog jumped up on me earlier. But I knew the intention. There was no franticness in the dog. But if you don't get over it, if you don't get handle it over time, I honestly think it could develop into something. I may be wrong, but it's about, can it? So if a dog's jumping up on everybody coming through the door, now, are they excited to see that person? Yes. But are they also taking control of that moment? Yes. So therefore, you're not taking control of the moment. Then the dog has a couple of bad experiences or doesn't like the person or has a bad experience with the dog or sees that you're weak one day. And then all before you know it, the dog's then jumping up a little bit more assertively. And it looks exactly the same as what it did when the dog was pleased to see them. So these things go under the radar and then they develop and they become bigger problems. And I feel like we're not nuanced enough with dogs. We look at behavior and go, that's either good or bad. And I'm never looking at behavior just like it's good or bad. I'm always looking at the motivations of the behavior. What's the motivations of a dog that's constantly patrolling outside or constantly looking out the window? Is it just interested, or is it actually looking for danger?
While you're here, then I'm going to completely cut. We had quite a few questions actually, but I think I'm going to prioritize my own needs first and talk about Rodney.
Yeah.
I have gone all out with socializing him just because I've seen the negative impacts of a dog that isn't well socialized. So he goes to doggy daycare. I walk him in the park. I actively seek out dogs in the park. And I also make use of a fabulous discovery I had, which is Borrow My Doggy, where people can't have
great
their own dog.
Yeah.
And then I lend him, which is great because I feel like I'm giving them the joy of having a dog. But also, in terms of my lifestyle and management, it's a lot easier for me to get through a working week when I don't have him, you know, five days a week. But you mentioned earlier that there is a risk of over-socializing dogs. How do I know when that's what I'm doing?
You'll start to see behaviors. And I remember having one client who said, I've got a puppy. I've done everything you're supposed to do. I've taken to this. I've taken to that. I've exposed him on the tube. I've done everything. But that was too much for that individual puppy. Now, that isn't too much for Rodney. Rodney's coping very well. The only thing Rodney is a little bit excited when he jumps up. That's all the problems we've got at the moment. But let's say that we take the puppy out into all these scenarios and the puppy's not ready for it. And not everybody is willing or ready to go through a process at the same speed. Mm. Like at school, I was not as smart academically as the other kids. Mm. Therefore, I got left behind. There's areas with these children or these kids I went to school with that I would excel in. And it's about understanding your individual dog and understanding what that individual dog needs. So rather than just follow a list of things you think you should do, let's look at a list of things that your dog needs. Now, your dog needs security. Your dog needs socialization. Your dog needs play. Your dog needs affection. Your dog needs leadership. Your dog needs to feel confident in this environment. So if you're going out there thinking about all those variables rather than just socialization, you're gonna get there. So if I took Rodney out for a walk, I'd be thinking, right, I want to socialize him with that dog and get him used to other dogs and get him used to people. But I also want to show him self-control. I also want to show him that I'll provide for his security needs. So let's say I'm with Rodney and then a dog gets in his space and Rodney looks uncomfortable. I'll go in and while I'm going in, I'll say hello to that dog. And as I'm saying hello, I might even push my hand forward and push that dog slightly off Rodney to say, and Rodney will get the message, Nigel's protecting me here. The dog will get the message, oh, I'll back off. And the owner will get the message, oh, he's a nice guy because he's just saying hello to my dog.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So I'm trying to get all three in one. But if I just sat back and didn't do any of that and I just let Rodney deal with every one of his battles, then he's
going to lose confidence.
He's going to lose confidence. That's it. He's going to lose confidence. You protect him. So it's always about understanding every variable, multivariate with everything we do. And I think the dog training world just has these kind of compartmentalized ideas. Like you've got to train your dog, you've got to socialize your dog, you've got to walk your dog, you've got to feed your dog. I mean, let's just take food. Yeah, you feed your dog. Yeah, but what food? So now I'm giving my dog this food. Okay, now how's that affecting the dog's organs?
That's really interesting you mentioned food, because I remember that was a point in your book that really stuck out to me, just because I'm quite interested in my own personal nutrition and health. And then looking at, obviously, we have an obesity problem in dogs in the UK. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of what people are feeding, sometimes it's quite shocking, the crap, basically, that people feed their dogs. And you did talk in your book about artificial additives, not just to dog food, but whatever, you know, the dogs are eating and how that can negatively impact on behaviour. Have you ever got to that as a root cause? Have you ever changed a dog's diet and seeing an improvement in behavior? Please say yes, because I love that. A good news story.
I've dealt with many of people that have told me about it, but 100% that has happened so many times, but by their owners.
Yeah. The other thing that I find really interesting, and again, it's that holding the mirror up, isn't it? And looking at your own personal life journey. For me, one of the biggest influences on me being calm and productive and happy was getting a good night's sleep, which for years I didn't realize I wasn't doing until I put steps in place to make sure I was doing it. So how much better and happier is a well-slept dog?
Oh, I could just, I'm just going to tell you a story on this one, which was bordering on tragic. And it was a client who they had a puppy at like 10 weeks, but they had to go away because there was a funeral at 18 weeks. The puppy was 18 weeks and they gave it with a dog sitter. Now the dog was terrified in this new environment and the dog was like barking and running around and the dog sitter just kept walking the dog. And outside the dog was even more traumatized. So they took this dog out for walks 5 hours a day, trying to tire this problem behavior out. But the problem behavior never came out, was never going to be addressed through exercising the dog. It was be through addressing the language and intimidation the dog was feeling. And all that dog needed was rest.
Mm.
All that dog needed was stop giving me attention, stop fussing over me. I'm already out of my depth. I'm in an environment I do not understand. But they thought, right, I've got to play with the dog. I've got to do this. Oh, he's biting now. Why is he biting? Because you're invading his space. Mm. Oh, he's biting. We need to take him out for a walk. Now you're taking him out in an environment he didn't understand. Now he's all upset and they could never calm him down because they never got to the root of the problem behavior.
One thing I was going to maybe ask was about the links, I would say, to in humans to chronic stress and disease. So when we are, you know, in a state of perpetual stress or anxiety, it often manifests itself physically in our bodies as ill health.
Yeah.
So I see the ill health bit as a vet, and you're seeing the mental health bit as a behaviorist. But I don't think we often make the link, do we?
No, that's a really good point. Yeah.
And we have talked before, haven't we, about, you know, almost joining forces, collaborative. And I think it was in the context of a TV show. Can we go in and look at some like this root cause analysis concept of, but really digging deep into not just the dog's lifestyle, but the owner's lifestyle as well.
Yeah.
And really trying to understand holistically what is happening from diet, nutrition, exercise, you know, all the stress, sleep, the whole kind of piece. Mm. I think it'd be really, really fascinating. Do you see any parallels between, like we're saying, if we refer to behavior as mental health issues in dogs that are parallel with their owners, where their owners may have issues as well?
Not necessarily parallels that they both got issues, but I would say the biggest demographic of clients I've got is between 35 and 45 year old single people. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. One, that 35 to 45 year old single person has got an overwhelming, strong maternal or paternal instinct. And I feel like they're babying. I also feel like they've not got a partner to fulfill needs. So they put it all onto the dog. And then as a result, the dog thinks that the owner needs them. And it's just something I see all the time. And then the dog cannot handle that responsibility and that manifests in a range of problem behavior. And you've almost got to get through, like I said earlier, to that intrapersonal awareness. That person's got to be aware of their actions and their needs. And I'm saying to some people, you know, you've got to get out of the house because the dog's got separation anxiety and they're fueling the fire by constantly fussing the dog. And it's just this thing that will never end. It's like, you've got to get out of the house. You've got to do this. You've got to get your needs met. You've got to come back in. You've got to be a leader. You've got to be a needs provider. You can't look like you need the dog because the dog is just then panicking.
I remember a conversation we had a number of years ago now where you said that your goal was to help 100,000 dogs.
Mm.
And I remember that conversation because I was like, wow, that is some goal. That is some hurdle. How far are you on that journey?
I predict, through the videos, I've got like 7.5 million views and I get comments and you know, feedback and personal emails. I would say, I mean, it's hard to say like how much you change the dog's life, but what I would say is, have I bettered the dog's life on some level? And I think it's in the region of 20,000-30,000.
Wow.
Mm.
That's amazing. Well, Nigel, thank you for your wisdom. Thank you for your expertise and thank you for helping those thousands of dogs. So from the dog-loving public of the UK, it's a massive thank you. Well done.
Oh, it was lovely to see you again and thanks so much for listening to those at home.
You've been listening to The Consult Room. I really hope you've enjoyed today's show. Please do subscribe, follow, or share this podcast. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you want to get in touch or collaborate, then do reach out to us at theconsultroom.co.uk or connect with me on social media as Dr. Paul the Vet or Dr. Paul Magdalone.